This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Angelica Ronald, Professor of Psychology and Genetics and Director of the Genes Environment Lifespan GEL Laboratory within the Center for Brain and Cognitive Development in the Department of Psychological Sciences at Birkbeck, University of London. Angelica, welcome. Thanks for joining me. Can you start with a brief introduction about yourself?
Hi, Jo. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here talking with you. So I'm a scientist at Birkbeck, and I'm also fortunate to have recently taken up the role of joint editor of JCPP. I'm looking forward to talking about my research with you.
Fantastic. And what prompted your interest in the work that you do?
Actually, I don't really have a big, meaningful sort of backstory to why I've become interested in autism and other areas of mental health. And perhaps that might inspire future scientists to feel, well, you don't necessarily have to have some, you know, large life event that led you to leads you to this particular role. I'm just really fascinated in areas of science and particularly in understanding the human brain and why we all think quite differently to one another in some ways, and understanding those differences, appreciating those differences, and trying to destigmatize them too, I think.
As I mentioned, you're the director of the GEL Lab, so I think it would be nice to start with a little bit about the aims of the GEL Laboratory.
Yeah, sure. So I moved to Birkbeck in 2007, and around a few years after that, I thought it'd be good to sort of have a lab group, which is quite typical for scientists. So I named it the Genes Environment Lifespan Laboratory because it sort of captures what we're aiming to do, really understanding causal influences, so the genetic and environmental influences across the lifespan, particularly influencing the causes of neurodevelopmental conditions such as autism and ADHD and other mental health conditions like depression and psychosis. And yeah, it's been super fun so far. I think, to be honest, the thing I get most gratification from in my role, as well as the fact that I do something that I'm super interested in, is supporting early career researchers and sort of watching them flourish. And I've been fortunate to have absolutely fantastic students and postdocs coming through my lab who now, some of them have their own labs or they've gone on to be doctors or clinical psychologists or other senior postdocs. So that's something I really love about the job, as well as the fact that I love what I'm actually studying.
Fantastic. Let's talk about some of the things that you're actually studying. And you have a very wide range of research interests. Can you start with autism and autistic traits? Can you tell me a bit about this work?
Autism is a neurodevelopmental condition, and clinicians decide if a child has autism based on their behaviours. So children are showing social communication difficulties or differences and restricted repetitive behaviours and interests. I started doing my work on autism in the early 2000s, and it was just around the time of the Andrew Wakefield scandal. So actually, nearly everyone knew what autism was by that point, whereas previously it was quite a niche topic as a researcher, and not everyone in the population knew what autism was. It was originally described by two clinicians, Kanna and Asperger, working separately in the 1950s. And it wasn't, for a long time, not a lot of people knew what autism was. But as I say, now it's better understood, which I think is generally a good thing. In my work, sort of both fortunately and unfortunately, in my early work in my PhD, I was doing something that was considered quite bizarre by the autism community, which was I was studying autistic traits in the general population. So in my PhD, I assessed around 10,000, might have been a few fewer, but a large number of eight-year-old children. And so we asked parents about the children's autistic traits, and we found out that autistic traits are sort of continuous. So many people show a degree of autistic-like tendencies or traits, and then children with autism score highly on these measures, as you'd imagine. And then with further work, we found that autistic traits appeared to be sort of on the same continuum as autism. It looked like actually autism was a bit like scoring at the extreme end of an autistic trait measure. And this was in contrast to how people had previously thought about autism, which was that it was a qualitatively distinct condition and you couldn't really understand anything about autism by studying typically developing children. And my work was taking a different angle to that, a perspective to that. And it was quite hard to get the first papers published. I was getting peer reviewers saying, this has nothing to do with autism, what you're doing. Whereas now, and for some time now, it's a widely accepted and in fact sort of proven to extent in science, as in there's various forms of evidence to support it, that autism and autistic traits are linked. Phenotypically, they are similar. And some of the same genes are involved in influencing autism, autistic traits. So this view is now much more widely accepted. And but it was sort of not exactly hard going at the start, but you know, it was as it is often with science. If you're doing something that not many people do and it doesn't really fit with the status quo, it's, you know, that's how it is. So it was a really exciting time to do that work in my PhD and postdoc, and I also did the first genome-wide association study of autistic traits, which really means that we're looking to identify new genes associated with autistic traits. We also did a second project to look at, you remember those symptoms I told you about that define autism, the social communication difficulties and the restricted repetitive behaviours and interests. We did a second set of analyses to look at, well, do the same causal influences play a role in those two sets of symptoms? We found that social communication difficulties and restricted repetitive behaviours and interests both show genetic and environmental influences, but it looks like different sets of genetic and environmental influences influence the different symptoms within autism. So that also kind of provided a slight earthquake in the autism field, because originally people were thinking autism as a sort of single construct and there'll be genes that influence having autism. And here we were coming up and saying, well, actually there might be pathways that lead you to have social difficulties and separate pathways that lead you to have restricted repetitive behaviors and interests. And to be diagnosed with autism, you've effectively inherited those two separate pathways. So it helped explain why some children only have one of the parts of autism. So some children just show the social communication difficulties and others just show the restricted repetitive behaviors and interests.
Really fascinating. Is that now widely accepted? I was thinking with the first ones that the use of the term spectrum, which is sort of in common parlance, suggests that perhaps the first ones have been taken on board very broadly.
Yeah, well, yes and no. The spectrum word originally came about, I believe, from Lorna Wing to emphasise the fact that within the autisms, there are many types of autism. And so hence there's a spectrum within autism. But also, as you say, a spectrum ranging from clinical autism to autistic traits in the general population. So the autistic traits approach is not to in any way minimise or attempt to reduce the idea of what autism is, but more to understand conceptually how autism relates to milder forms of autistic traits and whether that can help us understand both autistic traits and help us understand autism. And I think the work has shown that it does help us. In terms of your question of those fractionable findings, the idea of the different pathway findings being accepted, I think we now have a few different forms of evidence to support that idea. And that's really how an idea gets strengthened, is when you have independent replication from different groups and with different types of methods.
Another focus of your research is autism and co-occurring conditions such as ADHD. What can you share with regards to this research?
Yeah, that's been a really interesting one to be involved with, and also interesting to watch the changes in perspective over the years. So I started doing that analysis on, first of all, on the association between autism and ADHD in my postdoc. And at the time, autism researchers really considered themselves to be autism researchers, and they went to the autism conference, and they were located in one part of the building at the Institute of Psychiatry, as it was known then, at King's College London, where I worked. ADHD researchers went to ADHD conferences and worked in a different section of the building. And I was looking at what was known about the association between autism and ADHD, and there was hardly anything in the literature. And I thought, well, I'll do an analysis, because I had all these data where I'd collected the big sample of children for whom I'd collected autistic trait data. I'd also asked them about ADHD symptoms. And I didn't expect to find a strong association. These are two very distinct conditions. At the time, the diagnostic manuals did not allow clinicians to give a child both diagnoses at once. It was considered that if a child had autism if they showed any ADHD symptoms, this was just a sort of secondary byproduct of their autism. So I did these analyses and I was really shocked to find very strong associations between both autism and ADHD in the kind of clinical end, but also in terms of the traits often co-occur in the general population. And moreover, I found using twin model fitting analyses that the same set of genes, largely the same set of genes that were influencing autistic traits, also influenced ADHD traits, and the same for the clinical end. And this was kind of, again, a big shock. It wasn't so hard to publish, I don't know why, but maybe I just was had lucky, more wide, broad-thinking peer reviewers that time around. At the same time, another group in Australia, a paper by Angela Rearson, published a similar finding on adults, that there was a strong association between autistic traits and ADHD traits. So that was good. So we had two forms of parallel evidence on it. And it's since become widely, you know, acknowledged, and lots of different studies finding that autism and ADHD often co-occur and appear to have some of the same genes involved. And in 2013, the diagnostic manual, at least the American one, DSM-5, changed the rules. So a child can now have a diagnosis of both conditions, which one can only think must be helpful for families and the children to understand their behaviour, to understand their needs, to have both diagnoses.
Do you feel your research actually played a part in making that change happen?
One likes to hope so. No, I don't know. I think it was cited somewhere as playing a role, but I'm not going to take the only solo credit, of course. It's very much a team science situation, and there are several groups, including, remember, I mentioned the Australian one. So I think it's always valuable when you have a few different groups working on something and they can show things. It's effectively an independent replication.
Angelica, looking at some of your other research, you also look at infant traits predicting later childhood behaviour. Once again, can you talk through this line of work?
Yes, absolutely. So I joined Birkbeck in 2007, and they have one of the world's leading baby labs there, and lots of fantastic early work on early brain development. And I got talking to some collaborators there who'd collected eye tracking data on young babies, and another study where they had actually collected data on newborns. So just a few days after they were born in hospital in Italy, they'd collected some amazing data on where the babies were looking and how the babies were using their eyes just after birth. And what we decided to do is to follow up these children and find out about how they were doing developmentally. They'd got to school age. And then we did some analyses to look at, well, does the way that babies move their eyes, which is a very good clue towards visual attention, predict later behaviour? Again, not knowing what we'd find, and there wasn't really anything or very little on this topic in the field at the time. There was quite a lot on infant traits predicting later cognition, sort of IQ and other approaches, but there wasn't much on how infant traits predict later behaviour. And obviously, when you think about babies, they're quite hard to measure. It's quite hard to measure things in babies, especially when you need large samples like I do. And it's quite hard to know what to hypothesize about what would predict what. I mean, because there's a lot going on in infancy. It can be, you know, there's croup, or there's problems with feeding. You know, there might be lots of sort of confounds or sort of stochastic events that wouldn't really predict later behavior. Anyway, we found, amazingly, we did find that the way in which babies move their eyes did predict later hyperactivity. So the babies that weren't spending very long focusing on any one location, if that makes sense. So you have something called a saccade, where your eye focuses on one particular spot and then it moves to another one. The sort of fixation duration, which is the length of time you spend on any one spot, could be long or short, or, you know, somewhere in between. And we found that babies that sort of flicking their eyes around quicker than others, so not spending very long on any one location, had higher hyperactivity in later childhood, which was, I think, very interesting. And in a way, we had a bit of a replication in the sense that we could look at both the newborns and the slightly older infants in these two different samples. Not an ideal replication in the sense that they're not exactly the same, but obviously we were partly making do with what we had, because these studies would obviously take over half a decade long to do in themselves. But that was a really fun study, and led by another super PhD student I had, who who is now a lecturer at a university.
Is that type of finding, I mean, are those findings translated in any way into clinical practice?
It's funny you asked that, actually. We had some press relating to the findings at the time, and an American journalist said, "So you're going to find out which kid has ADHD as soon as they're born?" One has to have a lot of cautionary points about that. So the prediction is not one-to-one. So there is a significant finding, but it's not that all the babies who move their eyes quickly definitely developed ADHD. It's not that strong a cause or association. We would want to have more replications, and then you'd want to think about how you'd use that information in a very benign but potentially useful manner. So I know another group has done some work on early kind of training of attention in children who may be at risk of ADHD, and that, you know, you can perhaps help children to develop their attention in early childhood. So nothing in any way, you know, spooky or untoward, but very benign sort of supportive things that can help children with their attention who may be at risk of attention problems later on. But that's obviously a big jump from that initial, you know, this is a basic research study. And as I said, one of the first of its kind. So the first things to do would be to kind of check that they replicate and think about the effect size and think about what can you do next. But it's a really important point.
Let's look at a fourth area of your research. You look at psychotic-like experiences in adolescence and schizophrenia. Can you tell us a bit about this work?
I might sound a bit of a sort of someone who jumps between topics at this point to suddenly now be doing a lot of work on psychotic experiences. But in truth, when I walked into my interview for my PhD in 2001, I said, hi, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I'd really like to study either autism or schizophrenia, please. So they were my two main areas of interest, having come out of my undergraduate degree. And so the schizophrenia one had to lie dormant for a while, partly because I got put on another project that was on early childhood and I got involved in all that interesting autism work. But I kind of didn't forget it. And the opportunity came up to start a new project on psychotic-like experiences in adolescence. And I was obviously absolutely thrilled to be able to start that up, and fortunately got a bit of funding for it to do it. And the idea there was to take the symptoms of schizophrenia, so there are things like paranoia and hallucinations, as well as these things called negative symptoms where you lack motivation and speech and quite debilitating, and measure them as traits in adolescence where we find that they tend to be quite common. And the motivation there was, first of all, can you spot early signs of schizophrenia developing in adolescence? And also, what are these psychotic-like experiences in adolescence all about? What causes them? Are they really a problem, or are they kind of pass and parcel of the sort of tumult of adolescence and actually quite normal and not something to worry about too much? How can we differentiate problems in adolescence that are actually a warning sign that more serious mental health problems are on their way? And to what degree can we sort of say, actually, these are quite benign and, you know, a bit of typical level support will get the person through them? So that's where that kicked off, really. And we've really done quite a few studies linking to psychotic experiences in adolescents now. We did the first genome-wide association study of these, and we've looked at the associations between psychotic experiences and things like cannabis use, tobacco use, stressful life events, bullying, as well as other types of why they co-occur with other types of mental health problems like depression and sleep difficulties as well. So just trying to get a real full picture of what they are, why they happen, and when might they indicate a risk for later problems.
What are the findings around using traits as indicators?
They're much more common than schizophrenia. So psychotic experiences, if you categorise them, you can often find about 7 to 11% of teenagers are reporting having them. And they are caused by a mix of genes and environment. But it looks like environment plays a bigger role than it does for schizophrenia in the general population. And environments like stressful life events, cannabis use, and bullying are all associated with psychotic experiences. But not always. Sometimes it looks like the environment itself, such as cannabis use, co-occurs with psychotic experiences. But for other, what you might think of as environments like bullying, we didn't find it was really the case that bullying was acting as an environmental trigger for psychotic experiences. In our analyses, we found that being bullied is partly a heritable trait. So, which is an odd thing to say in a way, but if you think back to school, it's not always random who is bullied, unfortunately. So there might be some heritable traits that lead you to being more likely to be bullied than others. Does that make sense? And some of the same traits that may associate with you're likely to be bullied also influence your liability to have things like paranoia. So maybe it might be like a sort of slightly neurotic temperament. You know, if you're nervous and anxious, you know, those sort of sayings of like bullies or pick on people, they sort of think they can get away with, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's by no means saying anyone is ever to blame for being bullied, but more that in that particular circumstance, as I said, it might be that there are inherited predispositions to both being bullied and being paranoid. When one thinks about how to help children, it's important to do analyses like that to understand what's actually the causal pathway.
You've touched upon the research methods that you use. It's clearly something you really enjoy, finding the right method. Can you say a little bit more about this?
Yeah. So it's been an absolutely incredible time in which to be working in my field, because I don't know if there's ever been such a plethora of new methods coming out, you know, ever before in genetics. It's been incredibly exciting. So in some ways, some of my research is using research methods that were developed like 100 years ago or more, like people like Galton, you know, who devised the idea of studying related members of a family to look at nature and nurture. And the twin design is also, you know, really old, decades old, and still incredibly useful for understanding nature and nurture and its interplay. And then yet we also have this smorgasbord of molecular genetic and statistical genetic methods that have really come out in like the last 5 to 10 years that can do incredible things for us. So one of the things I'm very excited by is this method called LD score regression. But don't worry about its ugly name. I really think someone needs to rename it with something better, because it's such an incredible method. And what it means you can do is you can look at, do the same genes influence two different phenotypes or conditions or whatever you're studying, but the two things don't need to be measured in the same sample. So previously, say you wanted to understand to what degree does childhood autism predict Alzheimer's, you would need to do a study that lasted, what, 70 years, 90 years, right, to follow those people in real life to find out the association between those two things. But now, at least at the genetic level, if you have a data set of people with their genotypes and Alzheimer's, who have Alzheimer's, and you have a data set of children with autism and their DNA, you can link those two data sets and find out to what degree are the same biological pathways or the same genes involved in autism and Alzheimer's without waiting 70 years.
It's amazing how much it will advance the research.
Yeah. So maybe doing an analysis on autism and Alzheimer's wasn't on the top of your to-do list, but whatever two things you want to link together, the point is you don't have to have them in the same sample anymore. Whether it's you want to study brain structure and something in someone's blood, you don't need to do that on the same people. So it takes the pressure of what you do on any set of participants, but it also means it's much quicker, because you have a friend over in America who has a data set on brain structure, and you have a data set on something else, and you can link them together very quickly with this analysis. I find that very exciting. And that method came out, well, roughly 5 years ago. So there's been a lot to learn, but it's been really exciting learning all these new methods that can do so much.
Angelica, what other research projects excite you, either your own or those of your colleagues?
Oh, well, I'm constantly inspired by my colleagues, sort of past and present, really. In fact, I'm fortunate to have been supervised by people and also work with people now that, you know, I hugely admire, and that's definitely helps with the job. I'm really inspired by work on very large cohort studies where they demonstrate quite how many of us have mental health problems at some point in our lives. So, for example, the work by Temi Moffitt and Avshalom Kaspi with the Dunedin study where they show that a very large percentage of us in the population, or a very large percentage of the people in their sample, have had mental health problems over their lives, where that people have been followed from age 3 to up to age in their mid-40s. Because I think that helps us realise that mental health problems aren't a very rare event that is just happening to us and that we need to talk about. And hopefully remove some of the stigma by communicating the actuality that many of us have mental health problems at some point or another, that there is treatment available for them. And even just knowing that in itself, in a way, might help people a bit with their mental health problems, just knowing that they're not alone and this is quite a common problem to have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You joined the editorial board of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP, to take the role of joint editor. What have you brought to the role?
Well, I should probably ask others that, but what I've been hoping to bring is a little bit of knowledge about genetic methods, behaviour genetic methods, and these new statistical genetic methods I mentioned. The fact that I haven't stuck with just one condition in my research, I hope means that I'm open to, you know, a little bit of knowledge and understanding of a few different neurodevelopment and mental health conditions. But mainly, I'm just hoping I can honour the incredible lineage of the previous JCPP editors. Just an incredible list of outstanding psychiatrists and psychologists. And I'm just hoping to keep the standard up as high as it has been with the previous lot. Mainly just been a real honour.
And what role does the JCPP play in helping professionals keep abreast of cutting-edge research?
I think it's incredible. In my nearly 20-year career, JCPP has always been a sort of place to go for real common sense but high standard wisdom in our area, and knowing that the peer review process is incredibly robust. For example, I would just take this year's annual research review, which is basically a whole issue of reviews in specific areas written by leading experts in the field. And it's just a mind-blowing read of absolutely incredible ideas and reviews of the areas. It's just so incredible that the journal maintains such a high standard and keeps it all within sort of evidence-based. It has such a broad take on child psychology and psychiatry as well.
Talking about evidence-based science, we're in an age where there is so much unregulated material that can be accessed online. I'm wondering what else you think can be done to promote evidence-based science.
Yeah, well, this is a really topical point. We are in the middle of the COVID-19 lockdown. And I mean, one can see all around on Twitter and in the news and so on, the frustration that people have from unreliable sources, unreliable data, and journals such as JCPP, for our area, obviously just keep the standards very high by maintaining this robust peer review process, keeping these top editors involved. And JCPP is a sort of bedrock of that kind of an approach. Yeah, it's hugely important to promote evidence-based science. And I think we're feeling that particularly at the moment in this time.
Angelica, is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked?
I thought one thing I'd mention is my group we're sort of celebrating actually this year, albeit now online mainly because of the current situations, but we are celebrating the anniversary of Rosalind Franklin's birth. So she is a scientist who was born 100 years ago this year. She had an incredible career where she did work in areas of X-ray crystallography. She studied DNA molecule, and she also studied viruses, which is very topical for right now, as well as a lot of other things. And she worked at Birkbeck, so she's a Birkbeck alumni. She also worked at King's College London and Cambridge. And the famous story of her is that she did a year's worth of work in order to create this image using X-ray crystallography. And it was the image that demonstrated what the structure of the DNA molecule was. And that structure then revealed its function, its copying function. Anyway, this image she'd spent a year working on got taken off her desk by a male colleague and shown to Watson and Crick in the now famous anecdote or story. It's not an anecdote, it's a story. And then they wrote up their Nature paper on the structure and function of the DNA molecule. So she wasn't she didn't get a Nobel Prize at the time, but her colleagues did. So we're celebrating 100 years of her birth. And so it's a nice opportunity for me to say, if readers are interested in that, listeners are interested in that, sorry, we have some blog posts online. We've done two big workshops in schools where we talked about Rosalind Franklin and all the children extracted DNA from strawberries. So her original work has really, we're really, you know, thankful for that, because that has set the stage for our whole field of genetics since then. Also, my a female PhD student in my lab has written a nice blog post about, you know, the differences in doing a PhD as a female 100 years after Rosalind Franklin. So I just thought I'd mention that as a nice way to end. And there's a few links on our website if people are interested to look at them.
Angelica, thank you ever so much. It was really fascinating. For more details on Professor Angelica Ronald, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.